Check, check. All good? A conversation with U.S. men's national team head coach Greg Berhalter. Let's do it. You, on the other side of this virtual room, are U.S. men's national team head coach Greg Berhalter. I'm Bobby Warshaw. We very much appreciate Jordan and Charlie for giving us their feed for the day. And we are going to chat about the upcoming camp and set of games for the men's national team.
What's up, Bob?
So to start, Greg, I'd love to hear about the thing that's brought you the most joy from this team over the last year.
Wow. It's just been nice seeing the guys develop. You know, personally, with their clubs, and then collectively when we're together. You know, I think there's certain moments that you take real pride in. You know, I think about, you know, when they're together after being away from so long, just how they enjoy each other's company, enjoy being with each other. You know, those are things that we're really proud of, because it takes a lot of work to build that cohesion, and to see when they're in camp and when they leave camp, you know, everyone's hugging each other, and you know, it's a great feeling.
Is there a specific moment that comes to mind more than the others? Maybe it was off the field, maybe it was a goal where you're just like, man, I wish I could have that forever.
You know, it's some of the conversations we have with the group. You know, there's some conversations around mealtime and when guys are getting up and telling stories, and you know, those are the most memorable moments to me, just to see the brotherhood in action and see them really enjoying each other and communicating and talking through and talking about difficult things. You know, those are great moments because they go a long way in building a strong team.
That's awesome. To set the stage for the conversation, this camp will have four games. It starts with a friendly at Switzerland on May 30th. Then you return to the U.S. for back-to-back competitive games. First, against Honduras in the CONCACAF Nations League semifinal on June 3rd in Denver. Then the final or third place game on June 6th, also in Denver, and that would be against Mexico or Costa Rica from the other semifinal. Then you'll play another friendly against Costa Rica on June 9th in Utah. The Honduras match, the CONCACAF Nations League semi, will be the first competitive game in over a year. How are you thinking about the big picture objectives of this camp?
First and foremost is what we're trying to do is play, you know, the best possible opponents we can. And when the opportunity came up to play Switzerland, you know, it was something that is a great test for this group. They're preparing for the European Championships. You know, they have a very strong team, ranked 14th in the world. And it's going to be a really good game for us, good test for our group. So working backwards from there, you know, we thought, okay, you know, this is a Sunday in Europe and we play Thursday in Denver for a Nations League semifinal. How do we make this work, right? And when you think about it, it's the exact cadence that guys are going to have in World Cup qualifying. You know, they're going to be playing with their team in Europe on Saturday or Sunday. They're going to have to fly across the ocean and get ready for a Thursday qualifier. So, you know, for us, it's great practice. The staff is going to be there as well to actually go through what the players are going to having to go through, to see it firsthand. And then we kept the cadence like the World Cup qualifier, three game windows. So we go Thursday, Sunday, and then another Wednesday. And that's exactly what we're going to have to experience in the first two windows of qualifying. It's going to be difficult. It's going to be a challenge, but what it gives us is information. And I think that information will be valuable. You know, who can go three games? What do you have to rest? What does the third game look like? You know, there's a number of different variables that we're going to be able to get information on.
How do you balance? The information part is really interesting. How do you balance the objective of winning, right? You want to win Nations League with preparing for what is even more important in World Cup qualifying.
Well, let me ask you this, Bobby. You know, in World Cup qualifying, you want to win your games also, right? So you want to win that second game. Like, you want to win every game you're in. And, you know, this is, you know, if you're asking, should we have went to Denver the week before and trained in Denver to really prepare? Like, we're going to have to perform in this short of rest. In World Cup qualifying. And that's just the nature of our player pool. You know, a lot of guys are going to be coming from Europe. So we have to test it out now. And, you know, our priority is still to win, you know, to win all the games, you know, win the semifinal, win the final, and then, you know, win that third game.
What's the next layer under your evaluation? So camp ends and say you guys won all four. What do you think about next? Like, what's your next?
So I think it's about physical performance. It's about how we rotated the team, you know, how we're able to adjust to you know, to tired legs, playing style under this short of rest. You know, there's a whole under layer that we're going to be taking a look at. You know, we're looking at, you know, physical data, you know, our pressing, you know, how high up the field, how low do we need to be, all that. Like, it's going to be an interesting deep dive when the tournament's done.
One thing I'm always fascinated by is you and your staff have what you think is success. But as the fan watching on the couch, there are moments when we think that you guys play well or play poorly, and you might agree or disagree. So I'm curious, going into these games, what can the person listening or watching, how can they evaluate their performance or the progress?
I think the best way for them to evaluate is if we win. I really do, because that's, you know, again, that's what we're focused on at our level. We want to play our way. I think the guys have a good understanding of how we want to play, a good understanding of our game model, and we want to win. And, you know, in the national team, I think that's really important. You know, if you want to get fans behind you, it's hard for me to expect, you know, the fans to appreciate the nuances of building out of the back or high pressing when we're not winning games. You know, so for us, you know, we understand that, you know, for this group, it's about taking that next step and winning tournaments and winning games.
How long has that been approached with the national team? I mean, you've been with the team for over 2 years now. When does that become the focus compared to early on when you're building foundations?
Yeah, no, it's a good point. It's definitely been a pivot, and you're picking up on the pivot, and you should, because you know, it's now is the time, right? Now is the time when you go into a summer where you have two trophies and then you have World Cup qualifying and then you have the World Cup. We're talking about in a year and a half time, one cycle is going to be done, basically, right? And you know, and this group is going to define itself based on how we do in this year and a half. And so for us, you know, I think this group is highly talented. I think this group has a ton of potential, right? But now it's about going out and showing it. And I think we laid the groundwork, and guys are comfortable with who we are as a group. And now it's about, you know, performing.
So you talk about winning and you talk about how talented the group is. And I'm not going to ask you to pick lineups for these upcoming games, but I am curious to hear about your process of picking those lineups, of determining the shape, of setting the ideas for what you declare as games that you plan to win. And you have options. So what's that process like of putting the pieces together?
You know, I think it's a lot looking at the individual player profiles and what skill sets they have and how we can set them up to be most successful within our game structure. You know, we played 3-4-3 and a 4-3-3, and those have primarily been our systems. I think we're comfortable with those systems. I think we can go to either one based on what we need to do to compete and win that game. So, you know, I think we're in a pretty good spot.
I want to dig into that. And I know that this might not be for every fan, but you talk about the difference between the 4-3-3 and the 3-4-3. It's been discussed a million times how little, you know, the few number of hours you have with this group. How do you adequately switch between formations and still compete at a high level?
I think it's the principles, offensive principles, and what we do, like, that doesn't change. And those are things that, you know, our offensive principles in a 4-3-3 and a 3-4-3 are the same. They don't change. It's different people occupying the same position, right? Different profiles. So in a 3-4-3, it might be the wing backs really high. In the 4-3-3, maybe the wingers take that position. So it's interchangeable.
And it's funny because when you talk about interchangeable, that to me feels like a non-negligible difference. Is it something about the new generation of players that are more comfortable with those nuances? Or is there a structure that you can build as a group so that from a Wednesday to a Saturday, they can have pretty different approaches to their game?
Yeah, and I only talked about the offensive structure, right? So now defensively, it can be, you know, completely different. When a 4-3-3, you're pressing, you know, we're pressing with our wingers high and inside, the forwards hold in the middle. So we can do that differently in a 3-4-3. We can play in a back five if we need to. We can move the wing backs up. I think you have a lot more flexibility with your defensive structure. But the guys understand it. I mean, it's, you know, a lot was made of this Northern Ireland game and how we switched with 3-4-3. And, like, you know, looking at Gio, what he's done for his club, Christian, what he's done for his club, Anthony Robinson, what he does, like, all these guys have been doing it for their clubs. So it's no big deal.
When you talk about giving ideas to your players, or you talk about building your team's idea, right? Mm-hmm. Before it was, we play a 4-3-3. And then we started mm-hmm. to adapt the idea that maybe you have a defensive shape, a 4-4-2, and you attack in a 4-3-3, right? How do you build? Is there also a pressing shape? Is there also a deep block shape? Like, how many of these do you go into a specific camp with prepared to teach?
So I think the idea, what I've found is that, you know, if we define our game model as having 10 phases of play, right, would be build up from goalkeeper, build up from midfield, finishing attacks. Then it would be high press, mid block defending, low block defending. Then we'd have defensive transition, offensive transition, defensive set pieces, offensive set pieces, right? So those are the 10 phases of the game. What we'll do is we'll look at the opponent that we have, and then we'll say, okay, we know we have very little time in this camp, right? The guys are in camp on Tuesday or Monday, and we play on Thursday. What phases do we need to focus on in this game to make sure the players have good comprehension and good understanding? And then that's what we'll do. We'll train those phases of the game because those will be most relevant to the game, right? If we're playing against Cuba, for example, you know, if we train build up from goalkeeper, we'd be wasting time because they're never going to high press us. So we won't even touch that phase of the game. And that's how we go about it. And then what you hope is that over time, you know, you're just layering the understanding of these phases of the game based on what formation we're playing, and they have an understanding for it. We just keep building on it.
And how much do you have to go through the building blocks of those ideas at this point versus the players know them and you're going to work on the detail and the execution of each one?
That's where we're at now, the detail and execution. So we, for example, in build up from midfield, we may say, okay, we're going to be pressed in a 4-2-3-1. You know, now let's focus on, you know, for the center backs, for the center mid, for our fullbacks, our positioning to be able to break lines and advance the attack, the positioning of our attacking mids, you know, all. It would just be the detail that we'll go through and we'll train.
One of the things that's always been great to watch about your teams has been the ideas in possession. And I'm going to use the term positional play. And I'm curious to hear if you use that same term or how you think about giving your players ideas that when they're in possession, that possession gets turned into goal scoring opportunities.
I think that's a big part of it. And I think, you know, one thing we found is that, you know, it's not necessarily talked about at a lot of the clubs that our guys are at, you know, just gaining positional advantages on the opponent and setting up in a way that we could take advantage of that. So that's a big focus of ours. And, you know, I think our guys, you know, have an understanding of that because we, you know, we talk about it constantly and we train it constantly.
I do want to back up a step because we've talked about the nuances of building your team, positional play, phases. How much at the national team level is you, Greg, and your staff giving them tactical concepts versus players coming in and performing? I know that's a broad question, but I'm just curious to hear in your eyes and your type of team, how you balance the team cohesion with ensuring the players, I mean, just players maximizing their performance. So I think about players like Yunus Musa or Weston McKennie, of course, Christian Pulisic, these players that have skills, particularly bypassing players on the dribble that are just so unique. So how do you build a positional player and a structure, but also saying, Weston, if you want to pass that guy, you do you and you be great?
Yeah, I think it's just game understanding, right? There's like, we want to take advantage. Our whole idea is to take advantage of the skill sets of our players, right? So, you know, we set them up, we put them in position, we put them in a structure. Within that structure, they have the freedom. And I think the structure is what gives them the freedom, that they understand what they need to do, but they also understand that they can operate, you know, based on who they are as a player. And, you know, it's interesting because when you talk about structure, people think it can be restrictive. And I almost think the opposite. I think a structure gives players more freedom.
I need to ask you to say more on that, because that to me is one of the key points of soccer. So how so? When a lot of people hear tactics, they think that the coach is telling a person what to do, and that is restricting the player's ability to make decisions, to be great, to show their personality. Yeah. And you're saying the opposite. And I'd love to hear you expand on that.
Well, let me ask you something. What do you think the greatest teams of all time were in soccer?
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about the old Hungarian teams, Ajax, Barcelona again.
Did they have structure?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So that's what I mean, is that what you're doing is you're giving the player options, and you're giving them a framework to operate and be themselves within that framework. And what I think is, because soccer is such a complex game, it's almost like, you know, if you go to the grocery store and you go down the cereal aisle and you see 1,000 boxes of cereals, you have no idea what cereal you want, right? But if the choices are smaller, right, then you know exactly what you want and you feel really good about your choice of the cereal.
It's always Cinnamon Toast Crunch. I'm not going to lie. It's always Cinnamon Toast Crunch. That's an easy decision.
Exactly. That's one of the best cereals of all time, by the way.
Oh, so good. Now to transition toward the individual players, because, I mean, what a year it's been for the individual players on this U.S. men's national team. And I guess just the first question I have to ask is, what are your weekends like? You know, what do you do on a Saturday and a Sunday?
Watch a lot of soccer, that's for sure. No, it's fun, you know, just watching the games and watching our guys perform and watching, you know, big teams, you know, watching Serginho, you know, go against Vinicius. And, you know, I mean, those games, you know, the best is the midweek, the Champions League, man, watching that, you know, and at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, watching these big teams go up against each other and us have players involved in that. So it's been an exciting year, you know, to think about having two Americans in the Champions League final is amazing. I mean, we've come so far as a country.
To hone in on the individual players, the first player I'd love to hear about is Timothy Weah. He's recently recovered from injury and returned to the field, and his team, Lille in France, was among the top two teams all year fighting with PSG. So what had started as a challenging year for him also brought some really meaningful moments as well.
Yeah, you know, Timmy is an example of a guy who's just, you know, dealt with adversity and has come out on the strong end of it and has done a great job. You know, his team, really compact, organized 4-4-2 defending, really good pace and transition, you know, interesting attacking players, workhorses in the midfield. You know, it's an interesting group, but, you know, I love what they've done so far this year. You know, and he's, you know, it's interesting to see how he's developed. When I'm watching his games, I think he's a lot more aware tactically, especially on the defensive side of it, you know, preventing central passes, like using triggers to press, starting from a compact shape, you know, so that's been fun to watch. And offensively, you know, he has this pace, he has this unpredictability, either playing wide or up front. That's been fun. He's had some great chances this year to score goals. He scored some goals. So overall, it's been a good year for Timmy.
On the topic of players who play wide, you have an outside back who plays for FC Barcelona, Sergiño Dest. Dest stands out to me because beyond his talent and the fact that he plays for Barcelona, he always looks like he's having fun on the field. And I'm not sure we've seen a men's player for the U.S. look as confident and as joyful as Dest does during games.
You know, Serginho's a guy that he needs to have fun and needs to have enjoyment and needs to feel like he can be himself on the field. That's a really important quality that needs to be there for Serginho. And, you know, and I love that. You know, it's almost like an artist type of mentality where he needs, you know, this freedom. And that's another example where within the structure, he has the freedom. You know, he can do things that you can't coach, you know, when he has the ball. So, you know, for him, it's saying, okay, this is the structure that you play within, but within that, you have a freedom to be yourself and express yourself. And, you know, it's been, I think, a really good progress from him this year.
The next player I want to ask about is a player who, and I'm watching your face to see if you know who this is right away, is I felt like it was, you made a decision on this player early in your tenure, and it felt like the first Greg Berhalter's team decision, that it's like, it was your time in charge now, and you were going to make hard decisions, whatever that meant. And it's Kellen Acosta, who in that first camp, you didn't keep with, you didn't roster for the games.
Yeah.
He had started against Mexico at Azteca about a year before. It felt like he was on the rise.
Yeah.
And now 2.5 years later, he is back in your team.
Yeah.
You started him the two games. So I'm curious, I would just like to hear about the progression that Kellen's taken as a player in your mold.
Yeah. And I wouldn't, you know, like I wouldn't, this isn't about me, you know, this is more about Kellen. This story is about Kellen because he's done such a good job of getting to this point, and it's all because of his hard work. And I wasn't trying to make a statement. We weren't trying to, you know, we're just looking at performance. And his performance in that first January camp wasn't up to par. And, you know, we spoke to him about it. And, you know, I think what I've seen from him since then is this amazing progression as a player, as a person. He's matured. He's open to instruction. He embraces it. You know, I mean, there's so much good with Kellen Acosta right now that he single-handedly, you know, earned his spot back into the team. And it has nothing to do with Greg or the coaching staff or anything. It has to do with Kellen. And I'm really proud of him. And that's a story. And I think it's also a lesson for anyone. It's not like all we're trying to do is put the best team on the field. All we're trying to do is, you know, qualify for the World Cup, perform well at the World Cup. That's what we're trying to do. And, you know, if guys are playing well, they're going to get opportunities.
As a leader, because I think that this is relatable to a lot of people listening in our own workplaces, that you want to reward those types of subjective performances, hard work, perseverance. So as a leader who you certainly need to win on the field and you certainly care about the tactical elements, how do you also find ways to make sure that the right players get rewarded for the things that matter to your culture and what you're building?
Well, that's exactly it. It is culture, you know, and that's what we do. And that's what we stress every single day. You know, like it's never, we want to win games, but it's never about it's win or nothing. You know, for us, it's about developing a team, developing an identity, developing who we are as a group, a strong team culture, and then reinforcing that every single camp, every single touch point. You know, the consistency of the messaging is there. And I think the guys appreciate that. They know that, you know, traits that we embody as a team, and we're always harping on that.
Yeah, I think about my own workplace, or I think about my old teams, and what separates them is not just the ability of the coach to get the most out of the best player, but the old saying, they truly care about the 25th person, because that's the person that often brings the most out of everyone else. Not that Kellen's first or 25th, but just that mindset of in general that we care about all of the things around the person and the culture and the environment, and we're going to reward those just as much as any goal or assist.
We care about everyone, you know, and you know, I hope that's the feeling that the players have, you know, that we're really behind them and really supporting them and really appreciate all the work they're doing with their clubs. And then when they come into our camp, and you know, another important thing I feel is just, you know, clear roles, clear responsibilities, and clear expectations. I think, you know, the more clear that is, the more it puts everyone in position to be successful.
But how do you, I mean, the thing that makes your job so hard is that you are working with people who have made it this far because they are so confident in what they do. They are so brave in what they do. So how do you have conversations with them to say, your role might not be what you wanted or expected?
It's just that. It's communication. I think it's extremely important. You know, I apologize. I just called a player yesterday and apologized for, you know, my lack of communication, for, you know, for not being clear enough with him. You know, this is a player that wasn't on the Nations League 40-man roster, And, you know, he looked into it and said, oh, that means I'm done with the national and this and that. And I said, you know, that's not the case at all. You know, and I apologize for not communicating that ahead of time. Here's the situation. And you know, here's where we see you. And we made this decision based on this information. And I think that went a long way with him. But, you know, I think I failed on the front end, not communicating to him ahead of time. And I think it's as leaders, it's for us to step up and you know, show vulnerability and show mistakes also, because we certainly make them.
I want to move on for the last block on more general questions, Greg. These don't necessarily have to do with the upcoming camp. They're just things I'd like to hear you talk about.
Okay.
So we already talked about you watching Champions League games and watching the U.S. men's national team players in the weekend. What is a thing that you've seen from around the soccer world lately that's made you pick up the phone and text a friend and be like, oh, crap, did you see that?
That's interesting. You know, I see a lot of mirroring right now. Like, I think if a team's playing a certain formation, specifically like a five in the back formation, you see the opponent mirror that formation often. You know, if you think of yesterday's game with Arsenal is a good example. You know, it's happening, you know, more and more is that teams deal with playing against five in the back by mirroring five in the back. And I think that's interesting. Instead of looking at it another way and say, okay, how can we take advantage of this five in the back? You know, how can we, you know, they resort to, I think, sometimes taking the easy way out.
So, you know, as we talk about the concept of mirroring and coaching decisions, I'm curious to hear for the youth coaches out there. You know, I imagine there'll be a lot listening to this. What's a piece of advice that you would have for them?
So I'm a broken record when I say this, and I've said this 100 times, and Michael and the guys in the call can or listening can probably attest to it. But the most important thing to me is you have your game model, right? You need to have a detailed game model. You need to have a way to teach that game model, and you need to have a way to train that game model. And all three of those things need to be linked, closely linked. And if you can do that, no matter what the game model is, you can be successful.
I imagine there's plenty of people listening to this that will say, what is a game model? Can you give a sentence on that definition?
Yeah. So for me, it's the idea that you want the behaviors that you want your team to carry out in each phase of the game. You know, so in each phase of the game, how do you want the game to look? And that's how I would describe it. And it's, you know, it could be anything, you know, anything that, you know, comes to the imagination.
So if you're a youth coach who really loves watching Liverpool, maybe you set your team up in a little bit more of a pressing and transition oriented. And that would be the pressing and the transition part of your game model.
Yeah. And then how do you operate in all phases, right? Because your pressing is going to get broken. What are you doing in a low block? How are you defending the penalty box? What does mid block look like? You know, if you look at Liverpool, sometimes they struggle when they get caught in a mid block, right? It's really hard with a 4-3-3 to gain that confidence to have your wingers move up when the center backs have time on the ball and your forward trying to press with one. So you see, like for me, when I think about a 4-3-3, it's I'm not comfortable in a mid block. I like a 4-3-3 to be pressing.
Yeah. I'm with you on that. It is weird that Liverpool doesn't switch to the 4-4-2. Everyone switches to a 4-4-2 in a mid or low block, except Liverpool.
Exactly, because it's stable. So, you know, I guess you're right. I was going to say sometimes they move 4-5-1 late in games. They go to a 4-4-2 sometimes. I gotta look at that. I think I have seen them at times late in games.
Do you have a sense of why is the 4-4-2 better in a mid or a low block?
It's stability. You know, remember when we had these conversations with the Karu when we moved into the Amoeba 4-4-2 that I talked about? It was so stable. It's like you can't penetrate it. You can't penetrate down the middle. You can't come through it. Can't come through the team. And I think it prevents easy forward progress. Mm-hmm. And that's what makes it, like, in my opinion, stable.
Yeah, there's something about the spacing between the players. That's the right spacing that it keeps everyone mentally engaged, but also gives them enough room that they can actually go cut off passing lanes and win the ball.
Yeah. And I think I think we're calling it a 4-4-2. I think it's like a 4-2-2-2, right? I think that's what it really looks like. You know, if you look at lines.
Because your at widest players, your wide midfielders or wingers are a little ahead of the center midfielders.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
Supporting both lines, back, midfield line, forward line.
And Greg, I've been watching you for a while and following your coaching career and your teams, but I feel like I don't know that much about you personally. And I'd love to know more about, first, can you talk to us about your wife and where you guys met and that incredibly important part of your life?
So we met at college, University of North Carolina. And the funny thing is I met her literally like the second day I was in college, and we ended up getting married. But she played soccer as well. She won four national championships with North Carolina. And after my junior year, when I went to Holland, she stayed back in the States, and, we had to continue a long distance relationship, which was really difficult. I never forget, like, those are times when, like, the calling rates were like, $2 a minute or something like that. And like, my phone bill was like half of my salary at the time. It was crazy how expensive the phone was. Thankfully, IDT came along a couple of years later and then really reduced the cost of international calling.
There's more people than we want to think about that are listening that don't remember the cards you had to use. You went down to the local store, you bought a card, you got 10 minutes on it, whatever it was, for a crazy amount, and that's what you had to use.
Yeah.
Greg, I want to hear more about those experiences of yours from playing abroad. You went to the Netherlands after playing in college, so you were slightly older than the players who are going now, and there are so many players going to Europe at a young age now. I've always felt that people don't appreciate how hard it is for young players to go by themselves to live and play abroad. You've been through it, and it gives you the ability to empathize with the current player pool. How do you remember that stage in your life and that transition?
It was scary, man. I talked about this before. I was on the plane, and just like, it was almost, like, you're on the plane. My family dropped me off at Kennedy Airport. I just was 20 years old and going to Holland and taking this step. And it's something I always wanted for some reason. I always talked about going over to Europe, even when I was 15, 16 years old. I don't know why I did, but I was talking about it. And, then actually doing it was scary. It's like the safety net's gone, you're on your own. And fortunately, I think it was my love for soccer that really just kept driving me, because it was something that, I never looked back. I was homesick. Of course I was homesick, and I counted the days until I got to go home. And then when I had to return, I was a mess again about returning, but I always did it, for 15 years. And it was just something where, the game, the roots of the game, the history of the game, the culture around soccer was so strong that, it made it really enjoyable.
Yeah, it's simultaneously a dream come true, and then you are eating Cinnamon Toast Crunch alone at night.
I got Fruity Pebbles. My parents would ship me Fruity Pebbles. You imagine that? That was my breakfast.
And you did it before Netflix. Like, I don't even know what your days were like.
I was watching Dutch TV. Thankfully, everything was with subtitles, so it was in English. I'd go to the movies and spend an afternoon in the movie theater just getting some English and getting some English culture. But to be honest, I met so many nice people and created relationships that last even to this day, from Zwolle, from my first club, all the way through. I have friends from all these countries and all these different cities, and it's been, it was really a great experience.
That's awesome. The final question here is, one thing I think is really great about the American soccer ecosystem right now is that there's a lot of great things to read and listen to and watch. And Greg, I'm curious to hear if you've seen anything out there from a person you just want to give a shout out to because you thought it was well done or well produced or that you enjoyed it.
Soccer related or just anything related?
Well, you can do either. I mean, preferably yeah. Soccer related, I guess. But. Yeah.
No, I like reading Spielverlagerung. I think they have some good articles and good, good deep dives. The one they did on Man City, yep. Like with all these contributors, that was pretty fun to read. I had some of the guys texting me about it from Spielverlagerung. But I think that they do good work. I love the tactical analysis of their work. I like reading books. I think, getting a different perspective outside of soccer, leadership books, cultural books, just different ways to look at. Adam Grant is a great author. Think Again is a great book.
It's somewhere in this room right now. I'm starting it next.
Yeah, no, it's a great book. I was able to speak to him about it, and just brilliant guy, and is able to make things really digestible. So I'd highly recommend that. Brian Levinson wrote a book, Shift Your Mind, which is a good book. Just look, people think that there's only one way to look at things, but just trying to understand that you could look at things from different perspectives. So a good example that he gives in the book is like, they talk about arrogance and how people have the perception that arrogance is always bad. But when you're performing on the field, you need a certain amount of arrogance. You need a certain amount, right? And if you have, if you have the arrogance in training, in training is where you want to have more of a student mentality, where you want to be learning and coachable, right? Where you don't want to have the arrogance. But when you perform on the field, you want to have the arrogance. So just that dynamic, how you can use, how arrogance all the time isn't good, but none of the time is also not good. I like that, those concepts.
With your players, can you teach that? Is that something that you think has to be innate at 15, or can you help a person develop that balance?
Well, I think, you're talking about mindset type of things, and you can certainly help them at all times with that. And that's something we focus on a lot with our players is mindset.
I feel like that's a piece that's evolved over the years. That 15, 20 years ago, a player had the mindset, or she or he did not. And now there's a real sense that, and it's everything. Everything about player development is so much better than it was, from the methodology to the technology. And this is just another part of it, that players are getting better at it every single day and year.
Sports science has been huge developments in sports science, right? So I completely agree. And now it's about the players taking advantage of that. Right. And understanding that they have all these tools available to keep them going, keep them performing at a high level.
So we're going to end here. And you and I have been chatting for about, 45 minutes now. And I would just love for you to chat, to say something directly to the fan base, because it is a great fan base. So instead of just us, I'm curious if you were to have, a sentence or two ahead of the first competitive games in a year.
Yeah.
What that would be.
No, I mean, it's about welcome back. We're so excited to be back. There's going to be fans in Denver, so we get to play in front of fans again. But what I'd say is that, it feels like it's a great time to get behind the team. The guys, it's such a good group of guys, such a humble group of guys. I can't believe when I'm in camp that, we have players from these clubs that we do, because they're down to earth, great guys, and they get along so well. And I think, they're on the verge of doing something big. And it's just, we understand it takes a lot of hard work. We understand that it takes consistent effort, sometimes a little bit of luck, but it's a great team. And, we're excited about this group.
Great. Thanks, Greg.
Thanks, Bobby.